Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, to celebrate Poetry Month, one of England's greatest living poets, Alice Oswald. The first woman to serve as the Oxford Professor of Poetry, a chair established in 1708, she's also won the Griffin Poetry Prize. I first heard about Alice Oswald in connection with her reshaping of the Iliad, Homer's great epic poem of the Trojan War. Oswald focused on the stories of the fallen Greek soldiers rather than the dramatic heroes, and she called her book Memorial, an excavation of the Iliad. She set her laments of these violent deaths against soaring images of the natural world. Memorial was a remarkable success, and Alice Oswald performed 90-minute recitations of the complete book by heart to standing ovations. Alice Oswald was born in London in 1966. Her mother, Lady Mary Keane, is a garden writer and designer whose projects would often come with housing, so Alice and her siblings grew up on the estates where their mother worked. Alice studied classics at Oxford and then horticulture and worked as a gardener in Devon. Her very first collection, The Things in the Gapstone Style, won the UK's Forward Poetry Prize. She won the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry with her next title, Dart, a book-length poem that traces the life of the River Dart and its inhabitants, human and animal, plants and insects, from its start in Cranmere Pool until it flows into the sea. Oswald embeds oral history in the natural world. She went on to win more prizes for her work, including the Ted Hughes Award. Her seventh book, Falling Awake, was the international winner of the 2017 Griffin Poetry Prize and a finalist for another Forward Poetry Prize. Alice Oswald now makes her home in Bristol, but when we spoke in 2016, she was living in Devon. I began by asking her to read a poem from Falling Awake called A Drink from Cranmere Pool.
A Drink from Cranmere Pool. Amphibious vagueness, neither pool nor land, under whose velvet three rivers spring to their tasks, in whose indecent hills, tired of my voice, I followed the advice of water, knelt and put my mouth to a socket in the grass, as if to an outlet of my own unveiled stoniness and sleepless flight. They say the herons used to hang like lamps here, giving off gloom. Now walkers float on the wings of their macks to this weep hole, where you can taste almost not water exactly.
Alice Oswald with her poem A Drink from Cranmere Pool from her new book Falling Awake. Where is Cranmere Pool?
It's a strange area in the middle of Dartmoor, which is not far from here. And it's called the Mother of Many Rivers because it's where the rivers of Devon start. So it's a kind of blanket bog in the middle of the moor, and the rivers start there. And it used to be a lake, but it's now just kind of vague, squidgy ground. It's very odd.
And there was a kist or stone tomb there, I think?
There was, that's right. And it was recently discovered by a walker, and some Bronze Age bones were found in there, the most incredible discovery of what they think was probably a Bronze Age priestess. Certainly it was female, and she had an incredible sort of little woven nettle bag and beads, more beads than they'd ever found on the moor before. And probably they think she was connected with the rivers that begin there, among which is the Dart, one of my favourite rivers.
That you've written a book about.
Yes.
Water imagery runs throughout your work. Why is that something you return to?
I am very, very interested in water. I'm interested in the way that it is a natural art form. It actually pictures the world for you. So, you know, you walk outside and you are suddenly able to see a flat world reflected in the river. So it's almost like nature's way of representing the world to you. But I think perhaps more than that, I'm an incredibly restless person, and I really admire the way water sheds itself all the time, and I learn a lot from that.
Just the flow of water, you mean?
Yeah, I sort of aim to be as fluid as water if I can be. I don't like settling into one kind of character. I like to shed myself as I go along.
Do you walk beside water a lot?
I do every day if I can. I live near a tidal part of the River Dart, and I try and walk it at low tide every day. I walk down the Harbourne and up the Dart, but that has to be timed with whenever the tide's out. So it means that I do a walk at a different time every day in the same place. And it's a lovely way to kind of keep track of the river.
And in the night as well? Because I was just thinking, if you're following the tides.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I quite often will do it at midnight or so. And quite often I'll get it slightly wrong and come back quite wet.
You were born in London. How did you first encounter nature?
Well, I was born in London, but my parents didn't live in London. I suppose I was lucky enough that my mother has always been a gardener, is now a garden designer and garden writer. So I always was able to live in these rather amazing gardens. And her style of gardening is very much that she doesn't over-order her plants. They kind of have their own identities, and there's a real sense in her gardens that the flowers are sort of being themselves rather than being what a human wants them to be. So in one sense, it was quite a kind of protected form of nature because it was generally within a garden. But in another sense, it was quite a good kind of close-up experience of the characters of flowers.
How much do you think her work influenced you? I mean, what did you learn about gardening and the natural world from her?
I rather resisted learning about gardening from her, because that's what children do, isn't it? So I suppose I just enjoyed her gardens very much. I particularly used to enjoy sleeping outside in the garden, and I can remember actually being kept awake by the smell of the plants, the smell of the tobacco plants, these extraordinary kind of white ghostly flowers that she used to grow. So yeah, it was a really extraordinary experience growing up with flowers being so kind of exuberant all around me. But I sort of resisted the sort of design elements of it. However, I did find that once I'd finished at university, I wanted to work outdoors, really. I was so used to spending a lot of time outside that I thought that was a good way forward. But I didn't want to go into the sort of intricacies of garden design. I really wanted just to be a kind of jobbing gardener.
What did your father do?
My father worked for a clearing bank, an ordinary bank in sort of country banker. But that doesn't describe him at all, because he used to write ballads under the desk. And he's not. I think he enjoyed the thing of sort of, you know, working with local people and helping their companies to sort of make sense. But he's quite an individual character.
So you're a sideways inheritor of them both in a way, I guess.
Yeah, very much so, I think.
Well, when you were a girl, you had an experience, you describe an experience that led to your becoming a writer. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we lived in quite a sort of rambling house. And, you know, as a child, one is always terrified at night. And certainly there was a room that was particularly terrifying. It was my sister's room. And I was sleeping in it one night and just couldn't sleep at all. And so I stayed awake the whole night. And the experience of seeing the dawn come up through the window was such a relief and so sort of miraculous and almost unexpected. I'd felt so kind of trapped in my own fear that I almost thought dawn wouldn't ever arrive. And I did actually sort of articulate to myself when I saw the light coming up that there weren't really the right words to describe that kind of experience. And so I wrote a rather pathetic poem about about that moment. But it did make me sort of think that one needed a different kind of language for some experiences in life, as perhaps a night language rather than a day language.
And you were going to become the creator of that language, or how did that translate into?
I you know, just very basically decided, okay, well, I'm going to be a poet. Up to that point, I thought I was going to be a policeman, but it changed, and I'm quite stubborn, so I then just stuck with that.
And poetry specifically, not some other form of writing?
No, I have never been driven to. I'm very bad at writing prose. I find it very difficult, and I don't really understand fiction. I like Joseph Conrad very much, but I can't read much other fiction.
Really?
Yeah, I just don't quite get make-believe, I'm afraid. I just start, you know, I read the first sentence of a novel that tells me something happened, and I'm just saying, but it didn't. So that's not a very good way to start. But there's something about Conrad, I can really feel his experience behind the telling. You know, perhaps I just do admire him for the fact that he really did have the experience of being at sea. So that I can kind of find my way through to the truth of it. But mostly I don't want to be told stories, really.
And poetry generally isn't about story.
Well, it is, because I'm so interested in epic poetry, which has this incredible surface story going through it. But I think that is more to do with form than fiction, whereas the novel becomes for me about, from the little I know about it, it seems to be about invention. Stories in poems seem to be more about a kind of shape of a poem, and also perhaps more about dream than invention. So they're about kind of interior truths, or the narrative of the soul, if you like.
And we went to Oxford and studied classics. Was that a natural?
That was a kind of almost accidental thing. I suppose I did get very obsessed with Homer at school. So I just sort of almost fell into studying classics. I didn't really want to study anything other than Homer. So it was slightly problematic when I was supposed to be studying Plato or Thucydides or something like that, because I just kept reading Homer, really. So it was a mixed experience, I suppose.
After graduating from Oxford, you worked as a gardener, although you studied classics and you had done some writing. What made you want to take up gardening full time?
Well, I suppose while I was at Oxford, I noticed that I needed to walk a lot. I didn't really like sitting in libraries. I do suffer from claustrophobia a bit. So I spent a lot of my time at Oxford walking. I used to walk at night quite a lot and just walking out of the town as far as I could, really. And so I was keen to do something physical, because it seemed to in some way be a better way of thinking than sitting still and thinking. And that was partly, I think, connected to my preoccupation with the Homeric poems, because it seemed to me that the language used in them was in some way more embodied than literary language. And I just really wanted to track down what it was about that language that gave it a much more lively presence than literary language. And my first instinct was that I needed to sort of get away from books and intellectual life and start thinking with my hands, really.
There's such an abstract element to the shape, the sound of a poem, thinking with your hands. It's appealing. It's just hard to quite get a grip on.
Yeah, and in a way, it was a hunch that I followed, and it wasn't really till I started gardening that I realized what an extraordinary thing it was to be actually engaged in physical work all day, and how that really changed your perceptions. So I literally felt as if I was seeing colours more brightly and hearing sounds more sharply, because there was no kind of mediation between me and the world.
Could you read a poem from your collection, Falling Awake? This is a rushed account of the dew.
Mm-hmm. A rushed account of the dew. I, who can blink to break the spell of daylight. And what a sliding screen between worlds is a blink. I, who can hear the last 3 seconds in my head, but the present is beyond me. Listen. In this tiny moment of reflection, I want to work out what it's like to descend out of the dawn's mind and find a leaf and fasten the known to the unknown with a liquid cufflink and then unfasten. To be brief, to be almost actual. Oh, pristine example of claiming a place on the earth only to cancel.
Alice Oswald with her poem, A Rushed Account of the Dew, from her new book, Falling Awake. That word cancel comes as, it's almost harsh at the end. There's a tension in the work between the elements that sustain life and then those that undo it. Can you talk about your interest in that dynamic?
Well, I like the way things vanish. Again, that connects with me to the idea of oral poetry that isn't fixed. It's not there on a page. It exists in a performance and then it vanishes. And so I love and notice very much examples of that in the natural world where things sort of manage to exist in this sort of beautiful, tense moment and then suddenly they're not there anymore. And there's something very abrupt about the way things pass from presence into absence.
You said that there are tunes around us in the outdoors, and this in part inspires your writing. In what way tunes?
Well, you're very aware of tunes while you're gardening because you're mostly kind of looking down and you do hear the sort of sounds that go on, you know, like birdsong or chainsaws and strimmers, traffic, wind, rain. And you begin to, I think your brain is kind of subconsciously making patterns out of those sounds. So I really like that thing of the way the mind receives kind of multiple sounds and makes a shape out of them.
And do you think of gardening itself as rhythmic?
Very much so. And in fact, I particularly like being given rhythmical tasks in gardening. I love digging or potting up 100 plants or weeding without having to think too carefully about what I'm weeding around. So I'm not a brilliant gardener because I really like switching my mind off and just doing something really monotonous. That's my favourite thing. Raking is really a lovely job.
Really?
Yeah.
You like the repetition?
I absolutely love it, yeah.
Is it because repetition surfaces in your poetry as well at times?
It does. I think I'd be quite happy really working in a factory because I really like just doing the same thing for hours and hours.
Except that it's not outside.
It's not outside. That is a problem. And in fact, I did once work in a factory putting cream pot lids on and it really smelt of sour milk. So maybe I'd rather be outside.
The best nature poets by your lights are Homer, Ovid and Shakespeare. I mean, it's quite a lineup, but why those in particular?
Because they include the human as part of nature and I get quite fed up with this sort of urban idea that nature is just something sort of pastoral and pretty. And I think that's the way people in cities sometimes think of nature. Probably they don't in Canada, actually. But I think in England, there's a slightly kind of anemic view of what nature is. And Homer, Shakespeare and Ovid simply show the human and the natural world sort of passing between each other and through each other and sort of existing on the same level. And to me, it's really important to see the human as continuous with the natural world.
How does that manifest itself in your work, do you think?
Endless experiment, I suppose. But that happens, I think it really, in order for it to work in a poem, it has to actually be operating in the whole of your life. So it has to become a way of living rather than just a way of writing. So, yeah, I mean, it's sort of what I think about all the time if I'm outside is in what way my plant self is responding to the plants or my stone self is responding to the stones. Because it's very interesting the way you can kind of only look at something if you can find the same thing inside yourself. So every time you see something outdoors, you find that same form in yourself.
What would be an example of your stone self?
It's quite scary, the stone self, because it's so kind of stolid and almost dead. But it's that part of you that is really just kind of aware of light passing, but doesn't have a sort of emotional response to the world, I suppose. I'm really interested in the mineral self. I'm very interested in the water self and what that far away down part of you is that can look at water. One is used to people identifying with animals, quite used to them identifying with plants. But I think when you can get down to that kind of even beneath the reptile self, that mineral self, that really interests me.
A couple of years ago, you said you were intrigued by American poetry. Why in particular?
Well, because it was different. You know, I love sort of, I'll move into a kind of a section of poetry that I haven't known about before and get very excited about it, and then I move on. But I suppose because I started visiting America, I suddenly realized there was a wholly different way of looking at the world. And I liked the fact that it was using the same language as me, but seeming to use it in almost as if it was French, really, in a much, well, just in a totally different way. And a much wilder way, I think. I like the sort of chaos of American poetry. I like its kind of untetheredness. Perhaps there is something quite sort of rooted and human about English poetry, certainly about contemporary English poetry. It tends to speak with a sort of human and recognizable voice, whereas I like those American poets who kind of disconnect everything, so you're really sort of set loose into your own mind.
And what do you mean, French?
Well, it feels sort of intellectual and analytical in the same way that the French mind is, and sort of unconservative in the way that the French mind is. So someone like Mallarmé, I feel, is much more present in American poetry than in English poetry. And the sort of surrealism, I think, of the French poets seems to have gone into American poetry, but not much into English poetry.
Alice Oswald, the poem Tithonus is the longest work in your new collection, Falling Away. It's based on a Greek myth. Could you briefly recount that story?
Yeah, I've always loved that story. And it's the story of Dawn, who was quite a sort of flighty, flirtatious woman in Greek mythology, falling in love with Tithonus and asking Zeus to make him immortal. But she forgot to ask that he wouldn't grow old. So he just grew older and older, and she got quite bored of him because she's always getting up young every day. And so she locked him in a room, and in the Greek myth, we're told that he just goes on babbling to himself in that room. And Ovid later has him turning into a grasshopper, but mostly in Greek, he just carries on talking to himself and getting older and older and unable to die. So he's like a sort of very early Beckett character, stuck in that room, waiting for the dawn to appear.
And why have you always liked that myth? Is it pay attention to the fine print, or why would you?
I like it because I think poetry is always in some way dealing with time. It is, you know, meter is a way of managing time, or rather a way of kind of looking at actual time through artificial time. And in a way, that story sort of articulates that. It actually presents you with the idea of eternity, this man who simply can't die, but makes him married to the dawn, which is this totally different kind of time. You know, she just exists for certain regulated intervals every morning, and she doesn't grow old and he does grow old. So that beautiful kind of combination of different forms of time, I think in itself is like a picture of what poetry does. I think poetry sort of brings different forms of time together.
And by the time we meet Tithonus in your poem, he's been around a long time, 5,000 years.
That's right, yeah.
How has that affected his perceptions at this point? Although, I mean, you have him babbling, but he's still able to recognize the liminal or transitional quality of dawn.
Yes, he's very excited by dawn. And I was quite inspired by, for a while, we lived next door to a very old couple, and she had Alzheimer's and he was paralyzed. But they used to be always at their window looking out at dawn and sunset. And I just grew to think that he was Tithonus, because I just loved the fact that he was so sort of excited by seeing something that was such a kind of fresh beginning when he was so old and crippled. So, yeah, I think I partly modelled Tithonus on this old man who used to live next door to us.
How does Tithonus and maybe you see Dawn herself?
Well, she has that quality that fascinates me, that she is always on the point of being, but as soon as she arrives, she's gone. So she's completely ungraspable. And I think that she has that vitality that is what I'm after. You know, if I want to communicate one thing through my poems, it's vitality, really. It's kind of, what is it that living things have that is so sort of vanishing and yet so actual and so extraordinary. So she's like a sort of the essence of vitality, which is something you can't ever quite grasp.
It's the other end of the spectrum from the stone.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. And you know, because I always only bang on about one thing, it is sort of an image of the oral poem, that thing that is sort of, that is always a becoming thing. It's always a sort of on the point of being complete, but just as it begins to complete itself, it vanishes. So it's always a performance that's kind of set up and then melts away and leaves no trace.
We were talking about repetition, and there is a cyclical feel to much of your work in terms of seasons, tides, circadian rhythms. But the idea of immortality, as in the story of Tithonus, counters that life-death-renewal cycle. What did you want to say about that?
Well, in a way, those kind of things can only be spoken in poetry, because that has the kind of command of time to say something that's not really sayable. But I suppose I do think there are different ways of experiencing time, and that poetry, particularly through its repetitions or its resonance, does take you out of linear time and puts you into a kind of time where the past and the present and the future all seem to kind of ring in the same note. So in a way, it's not a linear idea of eternity, but a circular idea of eternity.
But in a sense, Tithonus suffers from eternity. I
mean, he suffers desperately from eternity. So he is kind of stuck in a linear eternity, but it's kind of touches on a circular one at the same time. So there's no kind of resolution between those two kinds, but I suppose I just show them both, really.
Does he long for death, or is he content to just wait for dawn to show up each morning?
I think he probably has all kinds of different feelings, but my sense is that actually it's awful to stay alive forever, and that he does desperately want to switch off, but he just can't. He sort of can't stop talking and can't stop being alive.
Could you read from the end of Tithonus?
Mm-hmm. As soon as the light, the first awake, as soon as earliness calling softly to the trees to be unsettled, please. She, whoever she is, who gropes for the mind and rips it open, as soon as that goddess, unconcealed, with the same unspoken sound as dew consents to the ground, and little shadows hurry undecidedly aside, quick, quick, in these final moments of closeness. Then, at last, whatever it is, 5:03, as the sun soars the morning into beams, with splintered eyes and incessant insect murmur of a man praying and rubbing his legs and hissing through a crack in his fleshboards. asks, "May I stop, please?"
Alice Oswald reading from her poem Tithonus. It's from her collection Falling Awake. That plea at the end is a cry for compassion. It's so polite, too. Until I read your poem, I'd forgotten that Zeus, or at least Ovid has Zeus, turned Tithonus into a cricket or a cicada. You mentioned Beckett. It's also kind of Kafkaesque. How do you see that transformation?
I just love those transformations, and I love the way the Greeks, it's almost like they, you know, when they heard that, like there's a line in Homer where he talks about the old men being like crickets or cicadas. And it's that they were listening so carefully to the sound of cicadas and sort of just noticed the kind of thin piping quality that is common to old men speaking as well. And the Greek mind really works by analogies and associations. So its truths are truths that they kind of discover by likenesses. And Plato also has this story about poets turning into cicadas or grasshoppers. So I've always really listened quite hard to grasshoppers because I think of them as poets. And funny enough, when I was in Amherst and I trespassed in Emily Dickinson's garden at night, and I was really amazed that it was full of cicadas. So I sort of have an interest in the cicada as being the insect that poets turn into. And I suppose it's just, if you go on speaking and speaking and speaking, you become nothing but a voice, and a sort of very, very high, continuous voice.
Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alice Oswald, as we were saying, you studied classics at university, and a few years ago you published a poem based on Homer's Iliad. You said that of all the poems you know, Homer's are more alive and contemporary than any others. What makes them so real?
Well, that's the question I think I've spent my life trying to work out. And I believe that it's to do with the way they were composed. I think that something about the sort of fleeting nature of oral performance allowed them to catch the fleeting nature of life itself. And I literally believe that the sheet of paper that a writer uses is like a kind of dead skin that makes them think of the world as in some way inert, that takes you right through to this kind of wasteland vision of a dead world that the modern mind suffers from. And I just think we need Homer because we need to be told that actually we're alive and we're in a living world.
So even though he isn't around to keep telling and changing and inhabiting his words, it's still more alive than our contemporaries?
In a very strange way, it just strikes you when you read those poems, they settle in the mind in a really different way from literary poems. And they kind of physically disturb you. You know, you really do feel as if an actual tree or sea or spear or human has kind of physically passed through your mind, not just a representation of that, but in some way that physical thing itself.
I was interested to read you make a distinction between early Greek and late Greek thinking, the difference between a what you call a more primitive approach versus a more analytic one. How does that work?
Well, again, I think it was probably to do with the advent of writing. And the Homeric poems happen, what we have of them is just on the edge as the oral mind is turning into the literate mind. And I think one cannot imagine what a change that was when suddenly the mind was able to fix things down on paper. People began to be able to think in all kinds of different ways, you know, logical thought was invented. So I like to spend a lot of time trying to imagine what it's like not being able to read and write. And of course, we've all experienced that as children, so it's not so far away. But I think one should be aware of what an incredible difference there is between a literary mind and an oral mind.
So who would be an example of a literary mind post-Homer?
Aristotle.
That's what I was Plato. Wondering. That's what I was thinking. The
Plato was an interesting
the
one.
The philosophers.
Yeah, the philosophers.
Not even
I mean,
the playwrights.
Plato's an interesting one because, well, the playwrights, it's interesting because they are so much working for a performance. You know, it is a performance and an audience. But then, you know, the philosophers really do sort of then begin to separate out thought from being.
And sorry, I interrupted you. You said Plato is an interesting one because...
He's an interesting one because, supposedly, he was kind of writing down what Socrates had spoken. So I think he's rather like Homer. He's kind of bridging that moment between spoken thought and written thought. So he's sort of got his foot in both camps, but he's panicked by that. And he's wanting to sort of formalize things and turn them into literature, I think.
What made you want to create your own version of the Iliad?
I think I don't see it as my own version. I really wanted to transmit the way I read the Iliad, which seemed to me quite different from English versions that I know. I always felt that English versions and American versions have this sort of... They have this idea of Homer being grand, and they've got this notion that epic should mean sort of noble and rather high-flown, and I have always felt that it's incredibly sort of fresh and ordinary and rather quiet. It doesn't seem to me to be a sort of thumping, trumpeting poem. It's quite sort of quiet and careful. So I just wanted to reveal that. It wasn't really that I wanted to do my own thing. I just wanted to show that.
Because you focus on the victims more than the heroes. I mean, the victims, many of them are heroic themselves, but that's not the storyline that you give your attention to.
Yes, I felt that so much has been made of this kind of glamorous idea of Achilles. You know, Achilles is a fascinating character, and I love that central drama of the Iliad. But I think he's been turned into something that rather drowns out all those other voices in the Iliad. And one of the things about the sort of style of Homer is that it feels incredibly even. There's a real sort of sense of a sort of democracy in the language, which means that you're not really able to put any one character in the poem above any other. And it really feels as if when he's attending to any old soldier who dies on the battlefield, he's giving it his full attention, and that person is as important as Achilles or Odysseus or Agamemnon.
Can you tell us briefly, this is maybe completely unreasonable, the story of the Iliad, just so people remember what you're setting it against.
Okay, well, the kind of the well-known story of the Iliad is the anger of Achilles. And Achilles was made angry by Agamemnon taking away the woman Briseis, whom he'd been given as a kind of battle prize. And so he decided to sulk. And because he took himself out of the battle, suddenly it meant that far more people died because the Trojans and the Greeks became so evenly matched. So corpse was piled upon corpse. And so it's really the story of all the deaths that were caused by Achilles being angry. And his anger didn't soften until he lost his own friend, Patroclus. And then he began to understand what a human is, really. So that's the story, really.
As the title suggests, Memorial is a kind of eulogy to the men who died, and most of them ordinary soldiers in the Trojan War. How did the Greeks mourn their dead? How did you want to reflect that in your poem?
Well, there are sort of interesting scraps we can learn about funerals. In fact, there's a bit sort of, I think it's in the Odyssey, where it talks about the women at a funeral. And so they'd have a professional poet and women, and they'd do this kind of antiphonal funeral laments where the professional poet would say something perhaps quite general and then the women would take it up with something particular. And Homer mentions that each woman would actually have her own grief that she'd really be mourning, even though she might be expressing grief about the body that they were currently lamenting. So I was interested in the fact that a lot of lament belonged to women. And certainly it seems to have been the case that women were so good at grieving for their dead that in the end, Solon in the 6th century had to ban them from grieving at the graves because they were going on sort of perpetuating grudges. So I felt that there was something female, there was that kind of strand of female lament in the Iliad that I might be allowed to grasp onto, being a female myself.
Could you read from Memorial? And this passage is about the soldier, Diores.
Yeah, okay. Diores, son of Amarynceus, struck by a flying flint, died in a puddle of his own guts. Slammed down into mud, he lies with his arms stretched out to his friends. And Pirous, the Thracian, you can tell him by his knotted hair, lies alongside him. He killed him and was killed. There seem to be black flints everywhere a man steps. Like through the jointed grass, the long-stemmed deer almost vanishes. But a hound has already found her flattened tracks, and he's running through the fields towards her. Like through the jointed grass, the long-stemmed deer almost vanishes. But a hound has already found her flattened tracks, and he's running through the fields towards her.
Alice Oswald with a passage from her book, Memorial. What is the relationship between the story, the recounting of the death, and the often nature-based simile that follows it?
I had a sense, I think, that the momentum of a man's life when he dies in battle, it's like he's kind of running and then he's suddenly stopped, but the kind of energy of his running is carried on into the natural world. So that the similes are, if you like, the ghosts of the soldiers. You kind of see the soldier again, but in terms of just the wind or a deer or the grass or whatever it might be. So really it's a picture of that person's absence, but there'll be something in the simile that in some way through analogy carries on that life, I suppose. And I like to think as well that they may, you know, these professional poets who would have been performing these Homeric poems probably would also have been used to kind of singing functional songs for harvest work or whatever. So they would have a whole lot of different work poems, if you like, that they would be able to dip into as they were kind of creating the Homeric poems.
And you repeat them because as a resting place, you need a little bit more rest because the descriptions are so vivid and upfront and violent.
Partly that, and partly because repetition is such a major part of Homeric poetry. And I like the fact that it really troubled people that I repeated, because I think it forces you to think this is a different style altogether. This is a different way of living in the world. You know, this is not the sort of novel-based, literature-based way of seeing things. This is something totally different. And I think I like the fact that people were made quite cross by that.
I like the repetition, and in fact, I'm always tempted. To have you say read each poem twice or recite each poem twice.
Well, that is interesting. And I notice that if I do a reading, people often say, actually, I wish you would have read that poem twice. And I think if you think in terms of poems being sounds rather than scripts, then there's every reason to repeat things.
You said you prefer the Iliad to the Odyssey, although I understand that you're also working on the Odyssey. So...
Yeah, I now almost prefer the Odyssey. I just think those two poems they're all you need. I mean, they're incredible. And at the moment, I'm just really fascinated by the Odyssey and by its slightly different and slightly more modern vision of what a human is. So that in the Iliad, humans they seem kind of emotional and impetuous and they act pretty suddenly, and then the Odyssey suddenly discovers free will, it discovers choice, and Odysseus is this character who thinks. You know, so often when you come to Odysseus, you're told that he hesitates and he makes some choice, and that seems to me a really, really fascinating moment when people suddenly realize this kind of ambiguous and suspended state that the human can enter. And I think actually that's what I'm more and more interested in, is that is putting the mind into that state where it stops being kind of tribally in favour of one thing or another and is able to suspend itself and be neither human nor plant nor animal nor anything, but is in this kind of watery, suspended state.
Alice Oswald, in your book, A Sleepwalk on the Severn, you look at the tidal landscape of the river during different phases of the moon and how it affects the lives of various characters. How do you feel the effects of the moon?
Well, I suppose I live near a tidal river, so I do take note of, you know, what phases the moon is in, because it affects what the tide's doing. And I love moonlight. I love walking by moonlight. I love the slightly kind of flatter world that it presents. It's a bit more of a represented world, and I really like that. And again, I think the moon has that same quality that water has, that it's endlessly changing and vanishing and coming back. So it's performing the same function in my mind as water, I think.
There's a dramatic, almost thrilling description of the tide at the mouth of the Severn River. Could you read that poem?
Mm-hmm. Crowds lining the banks. It's incredible when she visits her rivers, dragging her wave like a ghost robe right across the sea and earth and through everything. And everyone jumps into cars and starts driving urgently towards her, hypnotized together by the grey light. And they stand on the bank, zipped up, staring through cameras, or pressed into pub windows, or under the willows in the rain, running through fields in wetsuits, whooping, wanting to ride the very rim of the river wheel, to be rolled bodily along in its drowning. It's incredible when she lights the touch paper of her power. Sometimes she seems to have swum here, leaving a trail of moon slime on the line of the current. But it's incredible when she moves blind as a mole, groping her way forwards, and the smoky shine of water in its worn-out shoes goes slower and slower and slower, till the whole valley glimmers and glimmers like the summer of the underworld. And sometimes, at the very moment of her passing, which is like a river quake, like the weight of the sea, like the interstellar cold coming suddenly into the world, a man nips into the loo and misses the whole thing. And when he comes out, there's everyone clapping and hooting, and the river rushing backwards, trying to retrieve itself. It's as if he'd waited 2,000 years for a comet, which came when his back was turned. It's incredible. It's incredible when she chooses to push the river right over without caring. And there's the earth dangling in emptiness with its feet kicking the air. It's incredible when she floats along in her hammock, not breathless at all.
Alice Oswald reading from A Sleepwalk on the Severn. The Severn estuary is at the mouth of four rivers, the Severn, the Wye, the Usk, and the Avon. What's it like right at the estuary?
Well, when the tidal bore is coming up, it's really quite weird, actually. Because I spend a lot of time by rivers and I know rivers very well. But when a river starts flowing very fast backwards, you really suddenly become aware of the turning of the earth. Actually, you become aware of yourself as kind of standing on a planet with sort of tides and currents happening with incredible strength and force. It's quite a frightening and alienating feeling. And the Severn isn't a river that you can wander along either. It's got sinking mud. It's got a tide that comes in so fast that the amount of people who have drowned because they try to walk across the sand is uncountable. So it's got a very, very frightening feel to it.
A Sleepwalk on the Severn closes with a poem in the voice of someone called the Dream Secretary. I couldn't help wondering if what your relationship is with the Dream Secretary.
Well, I had a plan at one point with this poem to collect people's dreams. I was interested in tracking the dream life that happens by a river, and I thought it would be really interesting to gather people's dreams over a year and notice whether they change with a full moon or a new moon or something. But actually, that was much too ambitious. I sort of collected a few and they were terribly boring, so I gave up on that. But I quite liked the image that gave me such a kind of surreal task as to write down everybody's dreams. So I was slightly mocking myself as I turn up in these extraordinary places with my notebook, you know, trying to note down impossible things like the journeys of the moon or the tide or the river or the dead or whatever it might be. So I was seeing myself as this rather kind of pedantic character in an anorak with a notebook. Shushing people and trying to just get everything written down. So it was a sort of, yeah, it's a kind of a poet taken to the extreme, I suppose.
Alice Oswald, you say you read the works of other poets to be healed. Tell me about that.
I suppose I've just always used poetry as, I think, predominantly as a way of moving into a different form of time. I do think that it's quite weird the way we live inside linear time, and I think one needs a bit of relief from that. So I really love the way a poem just lifts you into repetition, really. Even a poem that doesn't seem to be repeating itself will always be using those patterns of repetition. And that does something very satisfying to the mind. But I think it's paradoxical what it does. On one level it heals, but on one level it also kind of opens up wounds and startles. I don't want poetry to be just healing. I also want it to be stimulating and disturbing.
I think unsettling is the word that...
Yeah, I think so.
In your poem, Aside, there's a reference to a child hiding in a laurel bush, and it says, "The hour has not yet ended in which, under a cloth of laurel, I sat quite still." And this still has a very intentional present tense feel to it. Do you still feel that a strong connection to how the natural world spoke to you as a child?
I think childhood is present for all of us in kind of very sharp ways. One suddenly kind of bumps into it, not necessarily all the time, but certainly if I go under a laurel tree, I'm always taken back to that moment and that particular sort of leathery feeling of laurel. And I'm not a nostalgic person at all, but I'm very interested in the different quality that the mind had before one could read or write. And perhaps, in some sense, one is searching for that kind of sharpness when one turns to poetry.
I'm so glad to have the chance to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Alice Oswald speaking to me from Plymouth, England in 2016. Her collection, Falling Awake, as well as Memorial, An Excavation of the Iliad, and A Sleepwalk on the Severn, are available in paperback from W.W. Norton. She describes her latest title, Nobody, as a book-length poem that lives in the murkiness between two stories from Homer's Odyssey. Today's show was produced by Mary Stinson, with thanks to Katie Swales and Olivia Pascarelli. The senior producer is Sandra Rabinovich. You can also hear Writers and Company on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, from Ireland and the U.S., Colm Tobin. I spoke with the award-winning author of Brooklyn, Nora Webster, The Master, and The Magician about his collection of stories called Mothers and Sons. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.